Hey, J. Crew, we are taping live from Crosstown Studios today, the apartment of Josh Cross. But not only the apartment of Josh Cross, actually his daughter's bedroom, which means we really should not swear. We should respect the space. So, God willing, it'll be a good, chaste, swear-free show. But in case it's not, here's your obscenity warning. This is Unorthodox, the universe's leading Jewish podcast. I am your host, Mark Oppenheimer, joined this week by Tablet senior writer, Liel Leibovitz.
Ahalan wa sahalan.
Yes, and Tablet deputy editor, Stephanie Butnick.
I have been second for like 6 weeks in a row.
Oh, sorry, I'll switch that.
No, I let it stand.
You know I switch it up.
They say first is the worst, second is the best.
Our Jewish guest this week is Albert Einstein. Okay, not really Albert Einstein, but kind of. It's actually Benjamin Cohen, who is the Twitter voice of Albert Einstein. He handles the Albert Einstein Twitter account, which has 8 trillion followers.
And Facebook.
Yeah, and Facebook.
And by the way, it's probably like better known right now than the actual Albert Einstein, because that's how most people learn about
like,
Einstein,
isn't it,
through Twitter these days.
It's at Albert, right? At Albert Einstein, is that what his name is?
And meanwhile, there are all these kids
Meanwhile,
there are all these kids who think that actually Albert Einstein is alive and tweeting at them because time has no meaning to children,
man,
right?
That guy is sick, so great.
Our Gentile guest is all-time super goy and parenting and sports columnist Jason Gay of the Wall Street Journal, who has been on the show before. It is totally terrific.
So the funny thing, we should say this is not Benjamin Cohen. This is Benjamin Cohen. This is not my Ben Cohen, who works with Jason Gay. So we're just we're giving you like a little tease of what you could have one day when Ben Cohen comes on this podcast.
If your Benjamin Cohen met Benjamin Cohen, that would be
the world
like,
would explode.
Benjamin. Benjamin.
One of my first correspondences with my Ben Cohen.
Your husband.
My now husband. We didn't really know each other at the time. He wrote something for Tablet and I helped get the story edited and put it in the system. And when it came out, he emailed and said, why is my byline Benjamin Z. Cohen? He's like, why did you put my middle initial? That's not my byline. And I was like, well, we have a Ben Cohen already. We have a Benjamin Cohen and we have a Benjamin Cohen. And I was like, so you're going to have to be Benjamin Z. Cohen.
You're Z. You're literally last in the alphabet.
I'm assuming
now.
The Z is Zachary, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Liel, anything new in Leibovitz land this week?
So Stephanie and I had a magical day on Sunday for an upcoming episode of this year's show.
Yeah.
Stephanie, where did we go? Let's tease this.
We went just near JFK Airport with the airplanes flying overhead. We went to see the Rebbe.
We went to the Ohel, the gravesite of Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the late Lubavitcher Rebbe.
So I was there once. Must have been about 2003. It was actually the first time I ever put on tefillin was at that site.
There's no better place.
At the yeshiva next to it, because I was interviewing a little boy who was going to have a bar mitzvah in Alaska, but he was at boarding school at the yeshiva at the Ohel. And that's where I went to meet him. And he was, so his 12-year-old, 13-year-old boy taught me how to put on tefillin right there in Queens with the planes flying overhead. What did you guys do at the Ohel? Did you write the little prayers and throw them up?
We wrote a letter.
Yeah.
I don't want to give too much away, but it was a very fun experience.
We wrote letters. We had cookies.
Yeah, I had those famous Ohel cookies.
And this is for the upcoming Superstition episode, right?
This is the world's longest preview for Halloween-themed, spooky, scary Superstition episode.
And this is a good time to say that when I put out the call for your family's Jewish superstitions, we got like a lot of them. And a lot of you wrote them in.
Including amazing ones.
A lot of you called them in. And we still want them more. It's better if you call them in and speak them slowly, maybe keep them to about a minute, and then we can put them right on the show. 914-570-4869.
And I have to say, having been raised by a woman who believed that leaving shoes like turned upside down is an affront to God and will like bring demons, our listeners' superstitions are amazing.
Amazing, right.
Like, that's some weird shit.
Because this is actually, you know, people a lot in the Facebook group are like, top sheets, are they Jewish? My family did this thing. Is it Jewish? This is actually where we get to see people's just like things that are definitely Jewish and are definitely totally crazy. Yeah.
I have to say on both sides of my family, and this may just reflect the sort of totally parv, schwach, lame, goyish people from whom I come, whom I love dearly and whom I'm deeply influenced by, but I can't think of a single superstition on either side of my family.
Oh my God.
Not my father's Yekish German Jews,
that
not my
insane.
Mother's communist Litvak Jews, like nothing. No, nobody.
Not even the Litvaks?
Nobody knocks on wood. Nobody says Kinahora. Nobody throws salt anywhere. Nobody spits at anything. Nobody. The thing about like a bunch of our listeners said that when you're mending something with a thread on someone, I'm not going to give it away, but it involved mending things. And I thought, yeah, if anyone I'm related to ever mended anything with a thread,
well,
maybe they have a superstition about
it.
We don't even
say,
mend
when
things.
I got my bat mitzvah dress made by Nancy fancy cinema on Long Island.
Salt.
You have to hold something in your, you put the string in your mouth if she's going to cut on you. So like
that's a big one. Yeah. A lot of our listeners had that one.
That was a good one.
It's the door Laszlo Holyfeld goes through in Real Genius.
This episode, we'll have a little seance, get a little Ouija board going.
Oh, I did have a Ouija board experience back when I was a kid, but we'll save that for the show.
That is objectively not Jewish.
That is definitely not Jewish. Stephanie, anything else to report or just the oh hell? Just
Oh hell no.
So at my household, really interesting what's come out the past 6 weeks or so. Because
is it a baby?
That's coming. You know, about 6 weeks ago, like the week we had the baby, Ellie started Ezra Academy, the wonderful conservative Jewish day school in Greater New Haven. And three of my other kids are in public school. And so all of a sudden, we hadn't really thought about this. We knew it, but we hadn't really grokked it deeply. Their holidays don't sync up, right? So Ellie gets basically the whole month of September off. But then her sisters don't get schnitzel, right? Then yesterday, it's Columbus Day, and her sisters finally get a holiday off, and Ellie has to go to school. And she was like livid. She's like, wait a second, everyone's going to be home without me? And they look at her like, Ellie, you literally haven't gone to school in a month. Like, while we've been going to school, doing homework, getting on Power School to check our grades or whatever the software is, you've been home, like, watching—
But not with her sisters.
—gymnastics YouTubes, but not with her sisters. So she was really upset. So I said to her—
She had that secular FOMO.
I said, Ellie, like, why do you think you should get the day off? And she said, well, because of my sisters. And she said, and because also it's Columbus Day. And I said, Ellie, do you know what Columbus Day is? She said, yeah, it's about that guy. And I said, you mean Christopher Columbus who, and I said, discovered America.
Mrs. Doubtfire, right? And a bunch of other great films.
I said, discovered America. I realize it's more complicated than that, but you know, this is my first Columbus lesson for her. And she said, yeah, him. And I said, well, and you should stay home for that? And she said, yeah, I want to stay home and honor him. I said, well, how will you be honoring him? And she said, by staying home. Which had a like brilliant Talmudic truth to it.
Absolutely.
I almost gave her the day off, but
I mean, if she had gone in with the like Indigenous Peoples Day, that would have been one thing.
Right, right.
Like, I don't know if you guys opened your calendars on your phone this year, and I had like 7 messages on my calendar that it was Columbus Day. I was like, why is so many people telling me it's Columbus Day? And then also one that says Indigenous Peoples Day, and the one that says Tablet in the Catskills Day.
Ah.
Which is actually a really important
day. A really important day. Little news of the Jews. I'm going to start with some quick bites, if I may, right? First of all, Amy Schumer, cousin of Senator Chuckles Schumer, arrested protesting the existence of Brett Kavanaugh. This was a great story. A Puerto Rican woman who had claimed to be Jewish trying to emigrate to Israel to avoid extradition got convicted anyway.
Well,
it never went
she
through.
Hired someone to kill her husband.
Yeah.
And she was like, if I go to Israel, can they extradite me? Also, might I be Jewish? She was like, 23 and me.
She's like, shalom.
Also, so that story came from yeshivaworld.com, which has the greatest ads I have ever seen.
Oh, my God. It's like always
modest,
ads
though,
for
all,
like Simcha halls and
I'm
stuff like that.
Yeah, I love it.
A Puerto Rican woman accused of hiring... yeshivaworld.com is also not the best copy edited publication. A Puerto Rico woman accused of hiring a hitman to kill her wealthy Canadian husband more than a decade ago was found guilty on Wednesday. 6 months after Anhang was killed, Vasquez sued his parents, seeking $1 million in damages and $8 million from his estate. I think that's called chutzpah, right? Kill your husband and sue the
it's
estate.
It's actually chutzpah, as Michelle Bachman says.
Shortly after filing the lawsuit, she left for Florence, Italy. Once there, prosecutors said she falsified documents to prove she was Jewish and thought about moving to Israel, asking an attorney whether the country had an extradition agreement with the United States. I actually think it's very shrewd. I mean, I think this woman's intellect is wasted in jail. I think that's some smart stuff. Seth Rogen is going to play a time-traveling Jewish pickle maker in an upcoming movie?
Say that 3 times fast. It's actually, the movie is based on Simon Rich's novella, Sellout, which is about like a Brooklyn, it's basically a pickle maker who gets trapped in a pickle barrel brining for 100 years and wakes up in like hipster Brooklyn. And it's like,
yeah,
dude,
I look perfectly at home here.
It's either based on some novella or it's based on a night of smoking a lot of weed and being like,
pickles.
Dude,
I'm hungry.
And the pickles. You know what would be a really funny movie? What if I'm a pickle maker and I fall into the pickle and then I wake up and I'm the same person because I'm a hipster?
The pickle factory is now like an abandoned warehouse performance space. So, you know.
Where they have pop-up pickle stores.
Yeah, basically.
Right?
It's like a Shouts and Murmurs.
He's set to play a young pickle maker named Herschel Greenbaum. That's awesome. And finally, a little quick hit from Israel. Sarah Netanyahu is on trial again.
Okay.
Like, could you explain, Liel, why... Are they, if they're corrupt, could we just put them in jail and exile them to Elba or something? If they're not, could we end with this? What
you
is going
Mark,
on with the Netanyahu and corruption investigation?
I wish I could explain. This is like indictment number 38. It's trial number 13. Like, there have been so many. Like, at this point, like, guys, if you've got something, you better bring it forward.
But and this has that, to do like, with a corrupt restaurant tab?
Oh, no. This has to do with, yeah, basically about ordering catering in. This is the thing. Like, the Netanyahus now are on, like, season 26. Like, the first four seasons were so great. You're like, this is the best show ever. These guys are so corrupt and interesting. Now it's like
basically House of
the
Cards.
Plot line will be that she ordered takeaway and it was too expensive.
In like, her really? In her not defense, she ordered $96,000 worth of private meals instead of using the residence's cook to prepare meals for her.
I mean, to be honest, if you look at my Seamless account, I'm not that far off. So,
And this is the same cook who presumably gave the shoe to the Japanese prime minister. Correct. So maybe it's fine.
I mean, Liel, to be fair, it sounds like what you're saying by sort of tossing it off is like, those are just my people. Where I come from, this is normal.
This is true. This is true. Where I come from.
Is like is, that basically in Israel, it's the soft bigotry of Loeb expectations. I mean, it's basically in Israel, it's the Middle East. It's a little different. $96,000 of catering. It's not $8 billion of arms. I mean, that is really bad. In a pre-Trump era, that would have been a presidential scandal that could have ended somebody.
I will say in the pre-Trump era, I don't remember the pre-Trump era anymore. It's been so long. I will say this. What she is arguing is that there have been no improprieties because countries and you know, mansions and big operations that have to do a lot of official kind of hosting, you know, often spend a significant amount of money. And she's arguing that this falls squarely within the reasonable. I think, you know, if you look at the Elysee Palace and what they must spend, I don't know. I have not looked at the, you know, at the bills, at the invoices of these things. The thing that really gets me is that these indictments come up literally every 3 months and there has been zero convictions, which strikes me as a little bit odd. Like at this point in the game.
So it's like Rod Rosenstein and the DOJ are like, out to get
just,
them.
Just do your thing. It's like the Mueller investigation. Like at this point, if there is Russian collusion, bring it forth. It's been a year and a half.
Oh, they
and
will.
If there's not.
Oh, they will.
Just walk slowly backwards and close the door after you.
Watergate took 2 years, man. That was
so
in my country.
Here's what JTA has to say that I think really brings it home. The Netanyahus have denied any wrongdoing and have accused Israel's public broadcaster of airing, quote, fake news.
And so it goes. Stephanie, what do you got for us in News of the Jews?
Okay, the greatest thing that happened this week is that Bernie Sanders like went out for lunch at work and literally like saved a woman from being hit by a car and then came back, like went back to work and didn't tell anyone in his office because it was just like just like a thing you do.
Just
and
a day in the life of Bernie Sanders.
This young woman posted a selfie on her Facebook saying, in caps, "Bernie Sanders, I kid you not, stop me from getting hit by a car on my way to my guitar lesson." So we took a selfie together. So there's a selfie and then it went up on Twitter. Like people started tweeting it, reporters. And then his staff saw it on Facebook and were like, Burn, did you save a woman from being hit by a car?
You
got to
tell your communications office this. You got to help us out here.
Yeah, we're like, this is what you pay us for.
Liel, News of the Jews in your corner.
So look, we've been lighthearted until now.
Yeah.
It's time to be a little bit more serious.
Take it down.
Something very bad happened last week. Something that I personally find very offensive and traumatic. After months of deliberations, the world body governing emojis, which I believe is Apple, officially came out with a bagel emoji.
The bagel emoji.
Have you seen the bagel emoji?
Is it the donut emoji they were threatening
the
us with?
The bagel emoji looks like the shittiest bagel you could buy in like the Denver airport oboe pond. It looks like
oboe pond.
You can see on that abomination the like bready texture of a shitty
you
bagel.
You can see the frost from the lender's freezer bag.
Can I say, save for a cinnamon raisin, which really would just have been a slap in the face, this is the worst thing they could have done. You know that the way our culture is going, historians of the future are basically only going to study emojis. That would be the only form of primary documents that anyone pays attention to. Like, oh, a bagel was that.
It was
like
a donut.
No, sir, it was not.
People must have eaten salads and tacos and those pieces of sushi.
And green kale smoothie. And they only drank this green thing. I have a News of the Jews item that is very delicate. I want to handle it very delicately. It begins with a very sad item. And you know, this is really painful stuff. 19 swastikas were spray painted on the walls of a Jewish community center in Northern Virginia. This was the Jewish community center of Northern Virginia in Fairfax. And they haven't caught the person yet. There is a surveillance video showing a man wearing dark clothes spraying the building at 4:30 in the morning. Now, here's where I want to take this, though. Because honestly, if I'm being perfectly honest with you guys in this room and the J. Crew and our body of millions of listeners, I have to be honest about where I was, where my heart was by the time I got to the end of the article.
What really offended you?
Here's what really, I'm just keeping it real. I'm not minimizing the tragedy. I'm just keeping it 1,000% real. Listen to this paragraph. Quote, as many of us recognize, these acts do not represent the community around the J or the community in Northern Virginia. Fairfax JCC Executive Director Jeff Danick and JCC Board President David Yaffe said in a statement. Let's unpack that for a moment. They said, these acts do not represent the community around the J. And at this point, I have to be honest, all I could think about for the rest of the article was another JCC that has rebranded itself as the J.
Who the fuck calls it the J?
Okay, increasingly, this is where you're wrong, Liel. Increasingly, everyone calls it the J. So in New Haven, the JCC had a rebranding after they had a fire and then they got some insurance money, they rebuilt, it's stunning, it's beautiful. The new billboards call it the J, like check out what's new at the J. I've seen this in the West Coast, I've seen it in the South. I think there's some company.
Is it like the Y?
There's some company that all the Jews are hiring, some marketing company that's told them, you got to go with the J. Nobody wants to say, the kids can't do three-letter acronym. The kids can't go JCC or more nefariously, if I'm to be Soros conspiracy-minded about it, they feel like JCC sounds like old. It's like where your old grandpa played like Pinochle or something. We're hip. It's just swoosh, the J. And I despise this. I mean, JCCs are what they are, right? It's like, we're not going to call it the fire station anymore. We're going to call it the F.
The F, right?
JCCs have this extraordinary century-long history rooted in the idea that Jews shouldn't just pray together, the kind of Reconstructionist Kaplanite idea that Jews shouldn't just pray together, but should also play ball together and play cards together and have dances together. It was a really important innovation, an American innovation, the idea of building a community center, just like the Christians had community centers. And you know, the idea that we're going to like cut the J, that we're going to throw aside the JCC label.
The CC.
The CC, the community centered. And here's the thing. There's no going back, right? Once JCC is forgotten, you're stuck with the J. And when the next branding company comes along in 20 years and wants to get even like, where are they going to go, right? So listen, this is what I have to say to the JCC of Northern Virginia. My heart really does break for you about these swastikas. Like anyone who listens to this show knows that this is a painful thing for us, right? We have definitely been on top of
anyone who listens to the show knows that we don't like Nazis.
But we don't like Nazis and our heart breaks for you. And if there's anything we can do to help, let us know. That said, whoever is rebranding any JCC a J, I'd like someone to come on and tell us why. I know someone in our listenership has been on a committee that's made this call, and I want to know the thinking behind it because I think it's wrong.
Mark, I don't think we've ever been more aligned on any subject in the history of that show.
Like, this is what really gets us up in the morning.
Oh, absolutely.
I have to say that our hometown JCC, the JCC Manhattan, is out now. Actually, the Marlene Meyerson JCC.
Like, they went
wrong. They're expanding.
They did the right thing.
But across town, on the east side, the 92nd Street Y is now 92Y, right? We give the old name a 92 out of 100.
Maybe, yeah.
This is a good time to announce that we're now known as
Unorth.
The U. You want to listen to the U?
Where'd you learn to tango?
With a French ambassador's daughter in her dorm room at Miss Porter's. And you?
With Nanette Himmelfarb, the rabbi's daughter at the Scarsdale Jewish Community Center.
It's hard to do this backwards.
You should try it in heels.
Our Jew of the Week is Benyamin Cohen. He's the author of My Jesus Year, A Rabbi's Son Wanders the Bible Belt in Search of His Own Faith. He's also the mastermind behind the official Albert Einstein Twitter account, which has more than 20 million followers. He's the host of the weekly podcast, Our Friend from Israel. Thanks for being here, our friend from West Virginia.
Thank you so much for having me.
And he lives in West Virginia, which is where I last saw him.
That's right. You came and visited us in Morgantown. You were the biggest celebrity to come in for a long time.
Thanks.
So how did you get this Einstein Twitter gig? Did you have to like try out for it?
Just write like 100 sample tweets?
I had to take a physics test. No, it's Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. Facebook is where he has the most, it's 20 million followers on Facebook and like, and then a lot on Instagram and Twitter as well. Einstein is one of the few dead celebrities who is A, big on social media, and B, very active on social media. I mean, I'm posting, you know, twice a day on Facebook, five times a day on Twitter, once or twice a day on Instagram. So it's an extremely active account. And
you know, I could get going. I could get J. Robert Oppenheimer going.
Yeah,
yeah. I could get him going. We'll
there are 19 million followers on Facebook
for Einstein.
Yeah,
yeah. No, Benjamin knows what he's doing.
I try. Well, I try. Last night, actually, if you go to Instagram, I posted a video of Einstein and David Ben-Gurion talking, which was a pretty cool little archival piece of footage that we found.
So how do you get this gig?
So the Einstein Archives is...
Because we're always looking for the perfect side gig. You know, you have... This sounds pretty cushy, actually. It sounds pretty cush.
Well, I wield a lot of power. I guess I could say that. The official Albert Einstein's, he left his estate to Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Because he really wanted the university to grow after his passing, because he was one of the founders of the university. And so he figured, he knew that people would want to use his likeness and things like that. So he gave the licensing and everything to Hebrew University. So anytime you buy a T-shirt or a coffee mug with Einstein on it, you know, Hebrew University is getting a shekel.
Wow.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the official Albert Einstein archives are in Hebrew University. The problem is right now they're in this small office the size of this room. And that's where the original general theory of relativity is kept, in a filing cabinet there.
It's being very well preserved.
But they just raised a bunch of money. So they deal, you know, they're very, you know, they have all the archives there. When Walter Isaacson wrote his famous Albert Einstein book, he went to the archives and he looked through all the letters and all that kind of stuff. But they really don't know how to deal with or want to deal with all the licensing aspects. So they license it out to a marketing company that's based here in New York. I think they have LA and New York, but the office I work for, I'm contracted with, is here in New York. They do a few dead celebrities' estates, but Al Einstein's the only one that's that active on social media. So Hebrew University hires them, and then they hired me.
Oh, okay. So, but how did you, Benjamin Cohen of West Virginia, of the West Virginia Cohens, how did you get the gig?
The Cohens and the McCoys. We have a big feud.
Yeah.
So it's a very strange story. So I write for a website called FromTheGrapevine.com, and we often write, it's basically positive stories about Israel. We also write a lot about Einstein, and the Israeli connection is because of the archives that are based in Israel. So anytime Einstein is in the news, I'll write a story somebody's auctioning. I'm actually meeting some guy tomorrow in Connecticut who claims to have a tuft of Einstein's hair, and he's auctioning it off, and so I'm going to look at it tomorrow.
So that you could clone him.
So exactly.
Are you looking at it to verify that
it's
real?
No, I'm writing an article. I'm going to write an article. And so anyway, so I would write these articles, and I wrote an article about Einstein, and I was like, hey, you know, I want to get, we're all trying to get readers to our stories online. And so I was, you know, looking, and I saw Einstein had a Facebook account. So I messaged him. I messaged Albert. And I said, hey, Albert, I wrote this story, we're on a first name basis. You know, he's a member of the tribe. And so, lo and behold, 5 minutes later, someone writes me back and says, oh, yeah, we'll share that story. We're always looking for Einstein content. And it turns out it was this 25-year-old millennial who was working for this company. And they had put him in charge, because he was the millennial. They had put him in charge of running the social media account for it. And so I became friends with this guy. And he's like, please send me more content. I'm always desperate for content.
This guy is like Troy from UCLA. He started as an intern in the mailroom. And one day they said, you want to be Einstein on Twitter? You want to your break into the big time?
He was a Fordham Law graduate.
There we go.
But so we became, over the course of a couple years, we became very friendly. I would, and we would talk, and we would say.
Friendly, except that you were gunning for his job, basically.
Yeah, no, I had no intention for that, because it was a very symbiotic relationship. I would write articles. I'd make up stories 10 people who share a birthday with Albert Einstein. You know, 10 times Albert Einstein has been in comic books and pop culture. You know, because it's just BuzzFeedy clicky stuff you have to invent, because Einstein is not in the news every day. But you need to generate the content. So for 2 years, I was providing him a lot of content. And then he decided, millennials, you know, they get distracted easily. He decided, you know what, I want to do something else now. He's now working at ABC News, actually. I'm going to be visiting him later today. And when he left, they're like, oh my gosh, who's going to take over? You know, who's going to take over for you? And he's like, I got the perfect guy. He's been providing me Einstein content for 2 years. And so I literally had no idea that he even recommended me. I just got a random phone call from his boss saying, you want to do it?
Okay, but now I want to sort of inside the Einstein studio type situation.
Yeah.
So you get the official gig. Now you're no longer providing content. Now you are Einstein on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. Do you have a method? Are you like Daniel Day-Lewis? Do people only call you Albert in your life, so you can.
So my wife,
it.
She's always, you know, Binyamin, can you pass the salt? And I don't answer unless she refers to me.
Do you wear tweed suits? I mean, what do you do to get into the character?
The interesting thing is they actually give me a lot of free reign about what I can post. They actually post science articles and stuff. But the one thing they told me when they gave me the job was I'm not supposed to embody Albert, so I don't say, "Boy, I'm feeling," or "I don't like this new thing," or "I, you know." You know, yeah, I have to say Albert Einstein doesn't like this thing.
I would never have treated John McCain that way.
So the famous, you know, I try to insert myself in the news when possible. Like, you know, like during the World Series, I photoshopped a picture of Einstein with a Houston Astros hat. And I said, you know, go Astros or something like that.
Oh, wow. So you can really editorialize.
Right. Oh, 100%. 100%. So they gave me an officially licensed Einstein bobblehead. And I take pictures of the Einstein bobblehead. Like at an event, like I could put it here and say, "Hey, we're at the Unorthodox Studios today." You know, that kind of a thing.
Did you bring Einstein?
Yeah, I didn't.
Einstein?
It's very
delicate.
Delicate, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the craziest thing is, so people misquote Einstein all the time. And so oftentimes, there's too many for me to correct. I have an official Einstein quote book they gave me, and so I reference that. And Ivanka Trump once quoted Einstein on Twitter. Okay? And here's what she said. This is the strangest thing.
If not me, who? Yeah. If not now, when?
On one foot. On
refugees are welcome. No. She said this on Twitter. If the facts don't fit the theory, change the facts. Albert Einstein.
And so you saw that and you were like,
Right.
So, I don't remember that one.
This is not. Actually, this was the guy before me. This was right before I had taken over.
Did he even say the real version of that?
Yeah.
Okay.
So first thing is, so he goes, Ivanka, I never said that. And it blew up and it went viral.
So in that case, he's allowed to be like, I never said that. Just
yeah, in that
so
instance,
funny.
It was kind of like a mic drop.
Yeah.
You know? It's funny. The book is divided into three parts. Things he said, things he didn't say, and things he might have said. And so they get this kind of gray territory.
So, first of all, I'm excited that Albert was so forward-looking. He was into branding. He knew he'd be a brand, and he
yes.
wanted Hebrew University to control his brand.
Yeah, I interviewed the curator of the Einstein Archives when I was in Israel recently, and he said, you know, Einstein considered himself one of the first celebrities, and he knew that, and people treated him as such. It was pre-Kardashian, you know, pre-social media, and he was way ahead of his time.
Now, Stephanie, didn't you read Binyamin's book in grad
school? Yes, my Jesus year.
So before Binyamin was Albert Einstein, he actually wrote one. He wrote one of these books.
Before he was Einstein, he was Jesus.
He was Jesus. He wrote, so Binyamin, who is a kippah wearing frummy here. I'm just
modern Orthodox.
I'm just reducing you to the simplest possible.
Yeah.
You know,
in West Virginia.
In West Virginia, you're the Orthodox Jew. You traveled the country, you traveled the Bible Belt talking to Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like how you say this in that wispy voice. Talking to Christians.
This is one of those books that, like, you know, for a while, everyone I knew in the religion-y community was, you know, had the book.
And the thing that was interesting to me, and I'll actually let you talk about it, but it's like you sort of start with this idea that, like, the temples are like, no one's in temple anymore, but like, there's so many, what are they called? Churches. And they're just full of people. And it sort of is like a very anthropological, it's a personal but also anthropological sense of like, what are they doing that we're not doing? And you were in sort of the perfect place to do that quest.
Literally, it's a perfect question, Stephanie. I grew up in the Bible Belt. And I literally, I mean, there's
Atlanta,
and there's a church on every corner. It's just like Starbucks, you know? And literally, my bedroom window looked out at a church across the street. And every
auspicious.
Sunday morning, I would see cars and people would come out in their khaki pants and press shirts and blonde hair. And everybody looked so happy.
So happy.
And the parking lot was full. And as you pointed out, most Jews in America do not go to synagogue regularly. You know, they'll go on high holidays, they'll go for a bar mitzvah. But most synagogues are not full on a regular basis. And most Jews don't even belong to synagogues. So I was wondering, what were they doing in church that's so, for lack of a better word, fun? And what can I learn from that? Not that I wanted to learn, you know, convert or go to church or anything. I wanted to learn what they were doing and figure out how we could bring it back to synagogues and make synagogues more accessible to people. Basically, I spent the entire year, I go to 52 different churches. Every Sunday, I go to a different denomination, Baptist, Pentecostal, Episcopal. I went knocking door to door with Mormon missionaries. And I kind of learned a lesson from each of these places. The one I like to tell people about is the first church I went to is the New Birth Missionary Baptist Megachurch. Right? It sounds like a long break.
Rolls off the tongue.
It rolls off the tongue.
Subtitles upon subtitles.
When I went there, it was the 13th largest church in America. It has 22,000 members. And they get, on a typical Sunday, 15,000, 20,000 people
Insane.
On a typical Sunday.
That's like high holiday numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
Across New York City.
Right, in the entire tri-state area. So I get there. Now, 15,000 people can't not park there. I didn't realize that. I just MapQuested how to get there because most people park like in other lots and there's shuttles taking them in. So I get there, I pull up, and thankfully, and I get there Jewish time, I get there a little late. And thankfully, right next to the handicap parking, they had first time visitor parking. You know, like
wow.
you have like new mom parking yeah. at the grocery store wow. sometimes. And I was like, I hadn't even walked into a church. And I'm like, wow, that is like the nicest thing. And that's something a synagogue can do. I'm not talking about bringing Jesus into the synagogue, but there's no reason why they can't get some paint and on the parking lot, paint first-time visitor parking.
You thought it was a spiritual solution. It's about parking.
It's customer service. Well, often it's customer service. They've got the food courts. They've got the services under 3 hours.
Well, not at this mega church.
No, actually, some of them go long.
Some of the mega
some of them go long.
I like
no,
that you went to
true.
Like the questioning Jew spot.
Yeah, so
they're like wondering about us.
So I walked into this mega church and I heard the one thing no Jew wants to hear when they walk into church. The usher says to me, "We've been expecting you."
Oh, Jesus.
So what happened was, because I was working at a magazine in Atlanta at the time, and one of my colleagues prayed at this church, and I had asked her some questions, what do I wear, because different churches have different dress codes, and I was asking her questions. She apparently told them I was coming. So the usher brings me into the sanctuary, and this is like, imagine like a theater that seats 15,000, like a concert hall. Upper seating, they have a...
They had press seats for you down front?
No, had press seats.
No, he was on a stage.
Oh.
So wait, it gets better. So there's like a 100-person choir on stage. I'm probably the only white person in the room. Everyone's up and dancing and hooting and hollering, and there's a band on stage, and there's these large screens, because people, like when you're at a rock concert, people can't see the stage, so they have these large monitors hanging from the roof, so people can see. So the usher brings me up to the front of the room, and like I said, I had gotten there late, and they're already dancing and in the spirit, and the usher whispers to the pastor something, and then the pastor turns around to the band, to the choir. He goes, "Everybody, quiet down, stop singing.
Oh,
I have a very
Lord.
Special announcement to make."
No.
Oh, my Lord.
"We'd like to welcome our Jewish friend, Benjamin Cohen, to services today." And all of a sudden, the videos came zooming in on my face, my Shane Upunim, 15 feet tall on Jesus' Jumbotron for everybody to see.
And the band goes, "Heaven no shalom."
And here I was in church for a minute, and I've already been outed as the Jew.
The Jew.
It's like the kiss cam, but worse.
Yes,
and how does this make you feel?
Oh my God, it was terrifying, yeah. Yeah, I mean, because when I grew up going to Jewish schools, and the only thing we had been taught about with Christians is they wanted to kill you then, so I didn't know anything.
I do want to say, as a fellow traveler amongst the Christians, because, this is what I did for a lot of my 20s and 30s, was hang out with evangelicals and Roman Catholics, Mormons, all that stuff. Your book, My Jesus Here, is a good book to give people who are curious about evangelical Christianity. It's a compassionate book. It's an honest book. But here's my question. Whenever someone has spent a lot of time among the Christians, as I have, as you have, were you ever tempted? Did you ever think like, gosh, they seem, first of all, the Jesus story is awesome. And it is kind of cool to think that he died for our sins and that, problem solved. And they do have better parking and better food court. Like, there's a lot they get right. Did you ever think, and you're a spiritual guy, did you ever think like, maybe this is, maybe
on,
they-
On the lonely Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, maybe they
like,
do know something. Maybe numbers count.
Bacon
numbers
smells
speak.
Delicious. Maybe I could do a trade-off here.
Well, I was not, to answer your question, I was not from a spiritual perspective. I was very attracted to the cultural aspects of Christianity and Christmas morning and presents. And I don't know if I mentioned this, but my wife is the daughter, she's the daughter of a Christian minister. She converted to Orthodox Judaism. And so her family keeps Christmas and everything. So I get to...
Keeps Christmas.
I know the expression to keep Christmas is
this is so
awesome.
Good. Observes Christmas.
She's showing me...
It's an Arab Christmas right.
She's
on the 24th.
If you go by them on Christmas morning, there's a tree.
Right. So she actually... I am probably the only person in America that has a stocking with the word Binyamin stitched into it. Yes.
So before we let you go, because obviously you could be here forever and we would have a great time. time, and we'll have you back. The latest project, because apparently being Albert Einstein on Twitter isn't a full-time job, but the latest project is your podcast, Our Friend from Israel, where you interview fascinating Israeli people in English. Do you want to tell us?
And so as an Israeli, you want to ask a question? I listen. Maze podcast.
I mean, if people are going to start with one episode of Our Friend from Israel, which one should they start with, and tell us a little bit about it?
So the point of the podcast is to show it's for an American audience. It's like you said, it's all in English, and people get enough politics and religion news about Israel. So my point is to do the exact opposite and show people, Israelis, that have nothing to do with politics or religion. So I interviewed a Harvard professor who's searching for aliens. You know, I interviewed a celebrity chef, Ron Ben Israel. I interviewed Gil Hovav, who you guys had on, mm-hmm. from Tel Aviv.
Celebrity chef.
So those types of people. My favorite episode, to answer your question, is an early episode we did with a classical piano player, American guy who moved to Israel later in life, classical pianist who got cancer. And because of the cancer and because of the disease, he lost the use of his right hand. So he only has one hand. And which, if that were me, you know, I probably would just like give up on life and a glass is half empty outlook. But he has such a positive outlook. He taught himself to play classical music one-handed. And so I went to his apartment in Israel and interviewed him. And he just has such an inspiring story. And I recorded him playing on the piano. So in the episode, you can hear him playing one-handed. And you close your eyes, you have no idea that he's playing one-handed. It's just such an inspiring story. That's one of my favorite episodes.
Amazing. So we can get Binyamin Cohen three different ways. We can get you as Albert Einstein. What's the account? It's at Albert Einstein.
At Albert Einstein on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
Or people can go read My Jesus Year, now in paperback.
My Jesus Year, now in paperback, available at fine booksellers and Amazon.
And Our Friend from Israel, available Stitcher, iTunes.
Yeah, or just go to ourfriendfromisrael.com and you could sign up there.
Binyamin Cohen, don't go back to West Virginia. Just stay. Why? You don't want to go back to West. Actually, it's pretty awesome in West Virginia.
It's beautiful there.
It's beautiful there. Your life,
Rhodes,
your wife is a professor
home.
There, right?
Yeah, my wife is a professor at West Virginia. She just got tenure a few months ago.
Mazel tov.
We're there.
Simon Tova Mazel.
And as Albert Einstein says, Fan Art Friday is coming up soon.
That's right. Check us out.
Binyamin, thank you for being our
thank
two of the
so
week.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here in person and not just listen on my headphones. Young and then the mountain going like a bee. From Tirol, take me home to the place I belong, where to make up my mama. We're here with Jason Gay. He is a sports columnist. He is the sports columnist at the Wall Street Journal and the author of Little Victories, a sports writer's notes on winning at life. Welcome back, Jason.
Hey, thank you, but I had no choice.
That's actually true. And you were last here in October of 2015, which is like a lifetime and a world ago.
The world was a different place, wasn't it?
A lot has changed.
Yeah.
We should also say, though, that but just because I want to get this out there, I think we've had only two returning Gentiles of the Week ever. It's you and Simon Doonan.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
All right. Well, I'm exactly like Simon. So it's a perfect combo.
I should also say that last time we all saw each other, we were dressed nicer than we are right now because we were at Stephanie's wedding.
Oh, that's true.
Stephanie, you were wearing a nice dress.
Not
like this nonsense you're doing right now. He was wearing a tuxedo. Now he's just with some polo nonsense.
Do you want to know what I got for Stephanie and Ben for a wedding present?
I would love it.
It was better than what I got him.
Stephanie, you want to tell him?
Oh, it was the best present. It's like this cat lounge scratcher thing that takes up roughly half the size of our apartment. Yeah.
It's
and
like
he loves it.
If you went to Design Within Reach for a cat.
A cat.
Okay.
He loves it.
But is
it.
That inappropriate for a wedding present?
I mean, I got them hand towels, so I think you win.
But you're right in the mainstream.
I know.
I'm a little bit on the
edge. It was great. Because he didn't get anything. And the card basically said, like, it gets better.
But you took the cat on the honeymoon, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, good.
So I want to dive right in. I have a sports columnist here. I've had to start paying attention to sports again because my 11-year-old daughter is obsessed with football.
Ooh.
And this
North is American football?
The Patriots, you might have heard of them.
Okay,
I actually know that they defeated the Dolphins the other day because the Miami Dolphins, right?
Yeah.
Because my daughter watches games on Sunday. And this is a weird thing because on the one hand, I need your help in processing this. On the one hand, like, we're supposed to be down on football now because concussions and dementia and all that stuff. On the other hand, it's kind of cool that my 11-year-old daughter is obsessed with football. So do I encourage this?
She's viewing against type. Ah, You know, it's probably watching North American football at her age is probably somewhat akin to when you and I were children and our parents decided whether or not they were going to let us watch professional wrestling.
Which they did.
Okay, so you know, there you have a little bit of a tracking. An interesting question is when and if she has her own children, if there will be North American football as we know it.
That was going to be an NFL, my follow-up question.
Right? You know, is what there? It's going to look like in a couple generations. I think we're going to see some version of it. I think, like, you know, the way that boxing has continued at sort of a, you know, lower level than it was generations ago, I think you'll always have a version of it. But
so we would have like a pay-per-view football game once every 3 years that people pay $100 to just
Vegas.
Watch them.
Right. Yeah, or use, you know, rogue football games behind chicken wire and country bars and stuff like that. But I think, frankly, that the game of football will change from the roots, and we're already seeing it, that parents, I mean, the question I hear most often from parents of 11-year-olds is, should I let them play?
Right.
And a great many more of them are saying no, or certainly no at the adolescent level and not until, you know, late high school or college.
Which is a heartbreak for Rebecca because she has a really good arm. She can throw a perfect spiral. I mean, she's really...
Is that true?
That's absolutely fantastic. The first time she picked up a football, she threw me a perfect spiral from 20 yards.
Has she seen, I'm going to not know the name, but there's a Helen Hunt after school special where Helen Hunt played the woman quarterback on the...
Quarterback Princess. 1983.
Dial it up, okay? Whoa. She has to watch this because I believe it's about a young woman with a perfect spiral in her ascension into the high school
football. Quarterback Princess, the Tom Brady story. Sorry, had to.
So you think that it will persist, but I mean, are you part of that, I've always said, woefully misguided camp that thinks soccer's actually going to take over America, that even though everyone's been saying that for 30 years.
Yeah, what's the Men in Blazers line? Sport of the future since 1972. Right. I mean, it's, I'm going to make no predictions about soccer's climb. I do feel that the way that the world has changed and, like, especially people's accessibility to European soccer and so on, the information people have at their fingertips, the amount of soccer they're able to watch, there's so many more informed soccer fans in the United States. You watch ESPN, they have Manchester United scores. That didn't happen as little as 5, 6, 7 years ago. So I think that is changing. But, you know, tackle football still has a sizable grip on the United States. And for all the sort of, you know, head scratching that happens up here in, wonky New York, it is, you know, still very much part of the fabric of a huge chunk of the country. I don't see it going away. But I do, because I hear so often from coaches that this is the number one thing that they hear about. Parental concerns, anxieties, about head injuries, about the long-term implication that the game will actually change. Like they're already working on that. Your daughter may have picked up on this. There's a lot of complaining that you can't really manhandle the quarterback like you once were
able
to. It's
not like the good old days.
Not like the good old Rock'em Sock'em days.
Right.
The game itself will change, but also, you know, the player pool will shrink.
So, Jason, we've been nice up until now. We've had our little
chit-chat.
Yeah,
bring it. I want to hear it.
We talked about all kinds of sports that don't really matter. Let's get real here and talk about the one sport that does matter, which, of course, is baseball.
Yeah.
Now, I love your work, man. I read you, you know, religiously. There's one column
a few weeks ago
that I have to say upset me a great deal about potential changes to the wonderful game of baseball. What are evil people trying to do to this beloved American pastime?
Well, baseball is kind of the stepchild of the American sports mainstream, is it not? I mean, it's the one sport that everyone seems very happy to kick and say is irrelevant and aging and not interesting to kids and too long.
My lord. Who are these people?
So I am in the camp that baseball probably needs some kind of modification.
Pass the smelling salts.
I did read a paper, and these are some very esteemed academics at New York University, just down the street from here, a professor named Stephen Broms, who is an acclaimed game theorist.
He's actually one of my favorite game theorists.
yeah, exactly. If you're going to go game theorist, go Broms.
Stephen Broms. Yeah.
Exactly. Had this idea, and this is a guy who studies, not just sports, but voting theory. Like, what's the fairest way for democracies, especially fledgling democracies, to vote, and, you know, parliamentary systems, and, you know, fairness and all these really important civic manners. But he's also a baseball guy, and he came up with this theory called the catch-up rule. And the catch-up, not the condiment, but the catch-up rule, like as in catching up, stipulates that a team that goes ahead in a baseball game, so it's 0-0, you hit a home run in the bottom half of your inning, you're up 1-0. Instead of having three outs, you got two. As long as you have that lead, you have two outs. Now, this statistically was sampled over the course of 100,000 games.
Right.
Brahms and his assistant went through 100,000 baseball games from, I believe, the late 1950s through now, and concluded that it did two things. It made the games a lot more competitive, many more games decided by, you know, two runs or less. The other thing is it shortened it by a half of an hour. So it did two things that, you know, every sport in 2018 should be excited about. It made it more competitive and it made it shorter. And so I said, well, why don't we just, you know, throw this out into the greater baseball atmosphere and see what happens?
And you receive death threats, I assume, from people like me. Are like, ha!
It's like next thing you'll be bringing in a designated hitter.
You know, it's also, not only was there a tremendous outrage from the get-go, but I feel like almost like a satellite, it is still reaching stars in the baseball system, and I still am getting hate mail like months later about it. Baseball fans were greatly sensitive about this. And my question to you is, I have written other things like saying baseball should have 7-inning games on weeknights, which I think is a very reasonable proposal. I've suggested that in blowouts, instead of teams turning to position players and possibly blowing out the arm of their right fielder, why not pull fans from the from the stadium and just let them pitch? I mean,
calm
the game's
down,
already decided.
Leibowitz.
You're looking for, yeah, wouldn't you want to participate in something like that?
I would do better than most of the Mets.
Those are frankly radical ideas. What was it about this
I'll tell you.
Sent people over the ledge?
I have a theory too, but what's your theory, Leo?
My theory is that those other things seem to actually kind of emanate from a certain kind of mock exasperation that derives from passion for the game. And this is like, this here is the elite, the statistician in the academy interfering with our beloved game.
I have a version of that. I think it strikes people who like competition, which is everyone who follows sports and all of us sometimes, right? It strikes people as sort of communistic and unfair because we have a constitutional right to pile on, to get to beat up on. I mean, the idea that just by virtue of winning a little bit, it's like a progressive income tax, right?
Nail on the
right?
head.
Right? You start piling. So you get one run up and you lose your right to go five runs up?
That's
like,
right.
Come on.
How dare you?
And this is exactly what people talk about progressive tax. It's like, I have accomplished great things in my life. You mean I get penalized more for doing that thing and accumulating money? That's absurd.
But I have to say that the obsession with making things, you know, shorter, quicker, it's like, don't blame, your attention span has suffered greatly because of your stupid screen addiction. Don't take it out on baseball. You know, baseball is a beautiful thing. It's an escape from all that other shit that I don't want to think about. I want to 14 innings long. Like, I want another 3 hours to every game. And I'm a Mets fan, so that's just pure pain.
What bores you? What's your nightmare assignment? Like, when you get set to, when you're in early round French Open or third day Tour de France, like, what's the thing? You're like, oh, Jesus, I really have to, I can't check my phone. I actually have to, something might actually happen.
Like, game two of a 7-game series. Like, that's just like, oh, man. Or like, yeah, like the opening round of a golf tournament or something where, you know, it doesn't have the kind of, consequences that, you know, obviously a game seven or some sort of championship has. I mean, it's the most popular sporting event in the United States, but something that's great about the Super Bowl is that at the end of it, you have a champion. You don't have a continuation of it. You have a result. And so that is sort of the optimal sporting event. You know, everyone's sort of paying attention and there's a result and a declaration at the end of it. But, you know, these sort of long lead, drawn out things. I mean, you know, baseball, not to bring it back to baseball, but not long ago, baseball, 162 game season went to a 163rd game for four of the National League qualifying teams to determine their placing in the playoff format. Don't you think if you have a 162 game season and you are not able to determine the order of the playoff, you have somewhat of a structural failing?
See, to me,
doing 162 of anything, you should pretty much have a clear idea.
That's
just suggests that there ought to be 360 of that. So here's the thing, you know, to relax. Every night, I watch baseball. That's
does
what
it work?
I do. Now, for you,
like melatonin, is that what it does?
You know, it puts
me, why you're so chill.
It puts me in a calm state of mind. what do you do? Because it's clearly not watching sports, which is work, right? I mean,
no, I can still watch sports for pleasure, for sure. Yeah, yeah. I don't want to ever get sort of disassociated from the idea that this is like a goof and entertainment for people. And I think, quite frankly, sports writers a lot of times over-professionalize the experience. They're sort of going into the locker room every time. They're sort of like in this sort of funnel where they're removed from paying customers who oftentimes are, most times are paying way too much to go to sporting events. I think the number one pet peeve I have about professional and high-level college sports in America is just how grotesquely overpriced it is.
Yeah.
But I do sort of, you know, want to always sort of have at least one foot in that world of what it's like to be an experiential sports fan, because that's what keeps us all in business. You know, that's what the whole essence of sports writing is reaching out and connecting with those people. So I get it. I mean, you know, will I sit and watch every Thursday night football game? Am I watching every round of, you know, the Cincinnati Western and Southern Open in tennis? Probably not. But I watch a good deal of it. It's, yeah, it is calming to me. I don't watch like serial television. I've never watched Game of Thrones. I don't know if anyone's... Yeah, is that same? Okay.
I started watching it, and then I actually came over to the Liel point of view that it's bad for the soul.
So
I watched
Game
a few
of Thrones
seasons.
Is?
Yeah,
it's, oh, interesting.
It's too nihilistic. So Jason Gay, author of Little Victories, which deals a lot with parenthood, father. How old are your kids now?
I have a 5-year-old son named Jesse and a 3-year-old daughter named JoJo.
What kind of sports lives do you hope for them? Are you a sports dad? Do you want them to be awesome players? Do you want them to be big fans? Do you just not care?
I'm somewhere between not caring and caring too much. I think that I want them to be active. You raise your 5 children. Are you in the city?
Or no, we live in New Haven. We're in mid-sized city.
Okay.
We have backyards.
But you have a backyard
stuff.
And yeah, a tree to look at and stuff
like
that.
The backyard's the crucial thing.
Yeah. And it's an essential thing. And especially, you know, my children are rather rambunctious. And so just any sort of physical exertion is incredibly useful because they just have to, you know, lower the gas tank a little bit over the course of the day. So sports is extremely useful in that way. They've not done like anything hardcore. They played a little bit of soccer. They played a little bit of t-ball. Mm-hmm. We had some t-ball action the last couple of springs. But, you know, right now they're kind of running around chasing butterflies, and I'm okay with that. I do think that, you know, the idea of doing something athletic and trying to get a little better at it would be exciting. They're also very blessed. Their mother is extremely athletic. So if they have any prowess, it's going to come from her. I'm interested to see how that happens because I think, you know, you can attest that, you know, one of the great joys of parenthood is to sort of see where it all comes from. And so my wife, for example, is very gymnastic. She was in a circus. You know, so if my kids are doing handstands at an early age, I'm gonna force them to do handstands. I think mm-hmm. I will force them to do that. So yeah, if they're walking on their hands by the age 10, I'll be very proud.
It shows good core strength and balance and all that.
It's a key part of the CrossFit experience, yeah.
And they maybe could get, they're like a circus alums. They could probably get in.
They're legacy circus kids? Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
You work with Mr. Stephanie Butnick, Benjamin Z. Cohen.
I do, yeah, Mr. Steph, yeah.
What's he like as a colleague?
Ben is, full stop, one of the most talented, you know, creative, original reporters I've ever met. Did I get it right, Stephanie?
Yeah. I'll give you your $20 later. I'll Venmo you.
No, with all my heart, I believe all that. He's incredibly talented. And not just talented, productive, and just, you know, he's the franchise, as we say. You know, like, he's the guy who you can build a whole operation around. I get great joy out of Ben sometimes because he takes things very seriously. Like, he'll read something dumb and it will like irritate him to his core
for like a long
like
time,
for a while. Like, you know, like I'm not going to point out anything, but it was probably something I wrote, but you know, he'll just get very, very agitated about that. And it reminds me of myself. Like, I was once that young man, nowhere near as talented as Ben is, but I was once the person who would just feel like, you know, the world was just full of morons. And now I just realize it's just me.
Do you feel like kids chilled you out a bit?
Yeah.
Like, how much are you going to worry about those morons when you have a parent-teacher conference to go to and a tooth fell out? And
parent-teacher tonight, actually.
Jason Gay, what's the next book? Your last book was The Extraordinary...
Can we talk about Ben Cohen just a tiny bit more?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
He's never been on the show.
Yeah.
Why is that? Is it just too awkward?
None of our spouses have been on the show.
No, he's going to come on, but he is, he's like, you know.
We should do a show that's each of our spouses in turn being interviewed by the other two. Like Lisa gets interviewed by the two of us.
I don't think Lisa would like that.
But Lisa wouldn't do it.
That's
great. That would be a great show.
Do I get to ask my question?
Oh, yeah. You came with the Gentile of the Week question?
My Gentile of the Week question.
How could we refuse a Gentile of the question?
Now, I feel like this is almost like it's probably been asked before. And like every sort of Gentile question, it has some origins in Seinfeld. But I want to know, like as a writer, I'm writing all the time in these columns. What is the fair use of a term like Michigas? Like, can I say, you know, like, look at the Mets, for example. Lots of Michigas with the Mets at all times. Like, using Michigas in a sentence. I've not done this, but it's a great word. You know, how would I not want to use it? What is appropriate and what's not?
Before we answer that, I just want to say that's a fabulous question, and we've never been asked that one before, I don't
Correct.
Think. And not just from the writerly point of view. I don't know that we've gotten a question from some Gentile saying, can I call someone a schmuck? But it's actually a very profound question.
I think there's a way in which Yiddish it's up for grabs at this point. Like, you using Michigas actually, I think, validates its place in like the larger American culture in a way. Like, I think like also kosher is a really good an adjective, like being like, oh, it's not kosher. Like, that to me is a very evocative word, and there's a way that Yiddish is. And like, look, you're like a writer in New York. Like, you basically you've earned it. You know?
Your last name is ethnically ambiguous. It could have been Goldfarb. Like and you're into sports. You're Jewish. Leo, what do you think?
I think, you know, language by design is supposed to be, you know, viral and you know, go everywhere people require it. Absolutely. Why not?
So I'm not co-opting it, you know?
You're not culturally appropriating it. You have a hechsher, as we say in this room.
The only thing I'll add is, if you're saying it aloud, just pronounce it right.
I think as long as it's not one column with, like, Michigas, schmuck, like all that stuff in it, that's offensive.
Yeah, don't put yourself in Jewish drag, but we don't do that either, because like if we ran a piece of tablet that like had chutzpah, Michigas,
right,
Mitndrenen.
See, and in a weird way, I am much more offended by like a tendency some you know, Jews have to end sentences like, this happened. Oi.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nothing kind of makes my blood curdle more than that. So like a writer using, you know, Michigas in the correct, you know, term is actually delightful.
Here's what you don't do though. Don't say, as my friend Ben Cohen would say, that was some real Michigas.
I would like for you to end a column with oi, just as its own sentence, as a request. You should start sneaking these words in and just like, wait, they're for Liel, like Easter eggs.
Okay.
If people want to spend more time with you, they can buy your book, Little Victories.
Sure.
Are you working on another book, Jason Gay?
I am, yes.
You give us a little sneak preview?
It has to do with the body. That's all I can say right now.
Does it have to do with wellness and yoga?
It has to do with the body. Just
can we follow you on Twitter?
You can follow me on the Twitter bot at Jason Gay, but that's a Russian bot. I don't do anything.
You just pay the...
Yeah.
And we can find you in the Wall Street Journal.
Where do I get a tablet lacrosse shirt, by the way?
I will send you a tablet lacrosse
shirt. It's phenomenal.
Isn't it so good?
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Jason Gay, wearing one right now.
Jason Gay, sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal, author of Little Victories, father of two, husband of one.
Friend of Ben Cohen.
Thank you for being our Gentile of the Week.
Sorry, co-worker of Ben Cohen.
You've done it all.
Thank you. Yeah, not friend. Yeah, just co-worker.
Intra-office nemesis of Ben
Thanks,
Cohen.
Thanks, Jason. Woo.
Let's go to the mailbox, ladies and gents, all right? Dear Unorthodox, I could be mistaken. Oh, this is a letter about the chicken farm versus chicken ranch controversy coming out of our Petaluma story.
Oh, it continues.
Dear Unorthodox, I could be mistaken, but I believe that the distinction is not whether a chicken grower properly refers to their site as a farm or a ranch. I've heard that vegetable, chicken, beef, whatever production sites are all referred to as ranches in California. This is a holdover from its Spanish origins, where everything was a rancho. I am an organic vegetable grower, and being located in Ohio, my site is a farm, but would probably be called a ranch if I were to live and work in California. Best, Evan Axelbaum.
I want to go to Axelbaum Farms.
Absolutely.
Maybe when we're in Cleveland for our live show, can we take a trip?
Totally. Dear Unorthodox, I'm a lone soldier and Ole Chadash, new arrival, right, from Dallas, Texas, currently living in a kibbutz in the south and serving north of Jerusalem. I spend most of my days either sitting in silence in front of computer screens on base or sitting in silence on buses to and from my home near the Gaza border. Whenever I get the chance, I put in my headphones and turn on Unorthodox. Your conversations make me feel closer to the warm, opinionated, funny, and loud American Jewish community that I left behind. Thank you for making me a less lonely lone soldier. Be'ahava, Matan Rudner. Now, Matan, this
my man,
this warms our hearts. We are so happy to be there for you. And this, of course, is the second week in a row that we've talked about lone soldiers, which are Americans who go to serve but don't have any family. Or it wouldn't just be Americans, right? It would be Jews from the diaspora who go to serve in the Israeli army, but they don't have family. And sure, they get some Shabbat dinners and some invitations, but, you know, it's lonely over there. I was intrigued, though, right, that you said that we make you feel closer to the warm, opinionated, funny, and loud Jewish community you came from, because that's always the selling point of Israel, is they say, like, come over here where everyone's warm, loud, funny, and opinionated.
Right, but I'll say two things about that. First of all, you know, gotta love a lot of things about the homeland here, but not always the most welcoming place for Americans who arrive. Sort of like, why do you talk with the accent? And what's wrong with you? Why you come here? You used to be from Connecticut. It's very nice. Why are you?
I have to say that when I was in Israel, everyone's like, are you going to move here? You should move here. Are you going to move here? Like, in every store I went into, people love Americans there.
And then once you move here, it's like, why did you move here? What's wrong with you?
We were just joking about moving here. I was like, because you told me
to. I've been trying to get to Scarsdale. What is this? Why you come here?
And second of all, he's a soldier. He has a job to do. He can't just, you know, dilly-dally around talking to people.
Matan, I'm so glad you're listening to us.
Yeah, Matan, we should do something for the lone soldiers. And by the way, I say that as an apolitical thing. Like, I don't want to be in any army. And that said, I'm still really intrigued and curious about people who voluntarily, especially voluntarily, join armies. And I think that it would be really interesting to talk to a bunch of lone soldiers. So I don't know, get a crew together and call us. We'll do some sort of hookup, Matan. If any of the rest of you want to write to us, write to unorthodox@tabletmag.com. And you could also call and leave us a voicemail message, 914-570-4869. We have this superstition show coming up, so definitely call and tell us about your family's crazy superstitions. Mazel tovs. Stephanie, have ye a mazel tov?
Yes, I do. So one of my favorite things about this show is sort of like reconnecting with people who I knew throughout my life who listened to the podcast unexpectedly. One of them is my little in Kappa Kappa Gamma, Danny Potter. She's out in LA. She is not Jewish, but dating a Jewish guy and has gotten into the podcast as sort of her intro to the people. And it's been hilarious. And she'll like text me after episodes. And I love it because I love talking
to her. So she was your little sib. She's your grand sib, basically.
No, she's my, my little. So yeah, so anyway, Danny went to Israel recently. I saw her Instagramming from Israel and I was like, yes, queen. And she was like, what's your address? I have something to send you. And she sent me a mezuzah. And she was just like, maybe being in the Holy Land, you'd like be more inspired to put it up. So now I have like a growing collection of mezuzot.
Right.
And I love it. And I love Danny Potter. And she's awesome.
You might end up one of those people who not only has one on the door to your apartment, but on every doorway inside.
I've decided that I want my apologue one on the inside of my, like on my door, on the archway to my bedroom.
Liel, mazel tovs.
Mazel tov this week goes out as it must to the newly resigned Ambassador to the United Nations, the great Nikki Haley.
Did she resign this week?
Just now.
Like what? Seconds ago?
Seconds ago.
Seconds ago. Why? Prepping her presidential run?
Because we're finally a podcast that like news breaks
during. The ways of the Lord.
Amazing. My mazel tov is to Rabbi Emma Gottlieb, who is heading to Cape Town in South Africa to join the rabbinic team at Temple Israel. She will be the first ever full-time female rabbi in Cape Town. And, you know, I think Emma Gottlieb must know this. And you guys know this. We are big in South Africa, like Australia and South Africa. There's something about those countries. Whenever I meet someone from one of those countries who's Jewish, they've heard
just
of the podcast.
Us.
And people will say, oh, like how many times have we gotten that note that says, oh, I was at this like Kiddush or I was at this Simcha or whatever in Cape Town or Johannesburg, or whatever. They were talking about the podcast. It's like, we're very big down there. We would love to get down
there. You know what? We love you too.
Yeah, we love you. We love you back. We love you back. Next week on the podcast, Judge Ruchi Fryer, the first ever female ultra-Orthodox civil judge in the whole United States. If you want to be prepared and have some free time, watch 93 Queen. It was a PBS documentary about her and her efforts to bring an all-female EMT corps to serve the ultra-Orthodox women of Brooklyn. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine on the web at tabletmag.com. You can ask for our newsletter. And you know, you should really get the newsletter because it's funny and interesting and Liel writes it. Get it by writing to unorthodox@tabletmag.com and putting newsletter in the subject line. We often come to you live to book us or to advertise with us. Email producer Josh Cross at jcross, that's Cross with a K, at tabletmag.com. jcross@tabletmag.com. You need to wear and carry Unorthodox? Hit up bit.ly/unorthoshirt and get those shirts, mugs, and stickers that look good on you and surround your coffee and keep it warm. Follow us on Instagram @UnorthodoxPodcast and on Twitter @Unorthodox_pod. Stephanie is on the Instagram at sbutnick. Join our Facebook group. Our show is produced by Josh Cross, Shira Talushkin, and Noah Levinson. Our editor is Sophia Steinert-Evoy. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our social media intern is Elazar Abrams. Our theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Our new-ish mailbox theme that you may have noticed is new-ish is by Steve Barton. Rabbinic supervision this week by Emma Gottlieb. We are normally at Argo Studios, but today we come to you from the daughter's bunk bedroom at Crosstown Studios up in Harlem. And we're proud to once have been part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.